Breakfast at Sally's, written by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 9. Oh, God! I pulled into the Driftwood Motel parking lot about 4 p.m. It appeared to be in my price range, just off the highway, a little shabby, with an outdoor pool that obviously had not been used for years. I parked the van and walked in. There was no one at the front desk, but I heard a woman's voice apparently talking on the phone in the back. "You know I don't like calling the police," I heard her say. Then there was silence for a moment. "Well, then you come down here and call the cops. You get them out of the room." Silence again. "Okay, okay. I'll tell them that they have to be out by 10 in the morning or we will call the cops. See you in the morning." Then I heard her hang up the phone and walk around the corner of the office. She looked a little surprised when she saw me. "Oh, hello. I didn't hear you come in. Do you want a room?" "Yes," I answered. "What is your rate?"
$48 a night, $54 with tax," she answered.
"Okay," I said, reaching for the money in my pocket.
"Just one night?"
"Just tonight," I replied, beginning to fill out the check-in card she handed me.
"We have a continental breakfast in the morning," she said,
pointing to a small table along the wall. It held a coffee pot on a hot plate and what appeared to be two stale glazed donuts lying on a serving tray.
"Checkout time is 10 a.m.
She glanced at the card I handed her.
"Cash or credit card?"
"Cash," I said, counting out the bills from the money Nurse Jane had given me.
"Oh, I forgot to ask," continued the desk clerk. "Do you have any pets? There is a $25 charge for pets."
No, I don't," I lied, hoping Willow wasn't barking in the van. She stuffed the cash in a drawer and then handed me a key.
"Room 203," she said. "It's at the end of the parking lot."
I quickly moved to the van and jumped in, hoping to get out of sight before she got a glimpse of Willow. We succeeded. There were only three other cars in the parking lot, and we drove toward our room. I parked the van and put Willow inside my coat to hide her from view, stepped spryly up to the second floor room, and turned the key in the lock, stepping inside, and closed the door quickly. "No barking tonight," I told Willow as I placed her on the bed, "or we will get kicked out." It was a nice little room, two double beds with bedspreads that were not too badly stained, and only a small rip in one of them. Willow cocked her head as she sat in the middle of the bed and looked at me. "We are going to have a bed tonight," I said, "and you are going to get a bath." Willow's white coat had turned gray. It had been months since she'd had a real bath. I turned on the TV and was greeted by the Jerry Springer Show. "Let's bring June's husband Randy out now," Jerry said as the man walked on stage to the whistles and applause of the audience. The man sat down in the chair next to his wife. Jerry sauntered toward the couple with a microphone in one hand and a piece of white paper in the other. "June, do you have something to tell Randy?" he asked, leaning forward.
"Randy," she began in a trembling voice, "I need to tell you that, well, I slept with your brother Buddy and with your father Sam."
Randy jumped up. "You bet!" I turned the TV off.
"Willow, it's time for a bath," I said, heading for the bathroom.
"Come on." She followed right behind. I found small bottles of shampoo and conditioner in the bathroom and ran water in the tub. Then I lifted Willow into her bath and lathered her up. As the grime began to wash away from the little dog's coat, I could see the sores from the flea bite she had endured during our travels. Her fur was so stained that I was sure she would never be the pure white snowball she had been. But Willow never complained. I thought once again that it would be best for her if I tried to find her a good home. Maybe some place where she could stay warm, get a bath every couple of weeks, go to the vet, get better food, and be brushed every day. But somehow, I couldn't bring myself to do that. It was about 8 p.m. or so when it began. Willow and I had both had our baths, and we were fortunate to find a movie on TV, The Natural. It was one of my favorites. Robert Redford had just been shot in a hotel room by some lady, and the scene where he begins his comeback as a baseball great was just beginning. I thought I had heard a champagne cork pop a little earlier and some giggling from the room next door. Now I could hear a woman's husky voice. Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! 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 Came the cries. Then there was silence, but not for long. God! 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 Oh, God! Oh, God! Is she in trouble? I wondered. I got out of bed and hesitantly put my ear to the wall. Nothing. So I got back in bed. A minute or so later, it began again. God! Please, God! Please, God! Please! Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! I got out of bed again and put my ear to the wall. God! God! Goddamn God! She moaned, and this time I could hear the squeak of the bed springs. The voice was getting louder and louder and more insistent. Willow the Wonder Dog jumped out of bed and went to the door and barked, as if to come to the woman's rescue. Shush, Willow! I plucked her up and brought her back to the bed in a single motion. Damn! Here I am, having not had sex for, hell, I couldn't remember how long, and I get a motel for the first time in 6 months, and I have to be right next door to what sounded like God having sex with a human. This can't last long, I told myself, turning up the television and climbing back into bed. But it did. It went on for hours. Every time Robert Redford hit one of his booming home runs on the screen, the yelling seemed to resume next door. When Redford was in one of his blue-eyed, reflective moments, all I could hear was, "Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!" Was this possibly God, the Creator himself, in the very act of creation in the room next door? Or was it evangelistic sex? Or was it more likely a Viagra copulation, guaranteed to last 5 hours before deflation? At the very least, I thought, she needed to expand her vocabulary. Perhaps she could add some adjectives, adverbs, and superlatives. You drive me crazy. Honey, you're so powerful. You're so big. Don't stop. Or even, yes, 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 darling. Drown me in your passionate seed. I considered slipping a note under the door with my suggestions, but thought better of it. It was about 11:30 that night when the action subsided. I guess they had stopped to watch Nightline. I was tired and drifted off to sleep. It was a good, deep sleep in a real bed. No dreams. But I remember my subconscious checking in sometime during the night, asking why I wasn't dreaming or if I wanted to dream. The "Oh God!" nightmare returned about 7:45 the next morning. I wanted so badly to just pull the covers back over my head and enjoy the warmth and softness of the bed and maybe sleep till noon. But I knew I didn't have enough money to stay another night, and soon the maid would come and discover Willow's presence, and then the innkeeper would want another $25 for our deception. I looked around the little motel room and then out the slit in the curtains and saw the rain falling from the gray sky. Dr. Z's pills and Jane's gift of a night in a bed had given me a ray of hope. I had an appointment at the local mental health clinic, and I wondered what the shrinks would have to say. Some magic words? Something from Freud or Jung? I pushed myself out of bed, took a shower, and dressed. I hid Willow under my coat, and we snuck out of the room, heading for whatever this day had in store. Chapter 10. Off to the Mental Institution. To the rhythmic beat of the wipers on the windshield of the van, my mind began to explore its expectations of the mental institution to which I was heading. Would the doctors wear white coats? Would they have beards like Freud and want to talk about my childhood? Would they attach wires to my skull and chest? Was there a nurse Ratchet like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Would Jack Nicholson be there to entertain the crazies? As I pulled into the parking lot, it was easy to see that this was a resort or the id. Patients were roaming peacefully around the grounds, drinking coffee, smoking, and chatting. There was a small pond just off the parking lot, giving Willow a chance to get out of the van, take a pee, and chase after a couple of ducks. The patients warmed to Willow quickly, calling her over for a quick pet and asking me the usual questions: what's her name? Is it a boy or girl? How old is she?
I used to have a dog that looked like that,
one lady said, bending over to scratch Willow's back.
Her name was Muffin. I had to give her up,
she said wistfully.
I couldn't take care of her. I didn't have the money for vets, food, or medicine.
Then she turned her attention to me.
Do you have an appointment? She asked.
Yes, I said, wondering if it was that obvious that I was crazy.
You know, you can take dogs in there, she said, pointing at the building. They like them.
That made me feel a little better, a little more relaxed and at home with the possibility of entering into a happy family. I picked Willow up and carried her into the building to find psychologists and psychiatrists bustling about with notepads and folders, attempting to be as calm and normal as possible with a lineup of neurotics waiting to be cured. This was a portal, I thought to myself. Maybe it was a black hole. I could enter it and find a new life, a new existence, a new focus. Or I could careen through time until I earned a room at Western State Hospital, where they had bars and locked everyone up at night. This was not the country club scene where the doctors arrived in their BMWs and Henry Grenthal suits and, to the tune of $200 an hour, talked to their clients about how to get along with their bosses at work or how to get over finding their husbands in bed with other women. Some of the patients here had scars where they had slashed their wrists or had gunshot wounds, broken arms, or black eyes. Some had jumped from the bridge, but somehow didn't drown. Hell, I wasn't even sure I qualified for help here. I hadn't even gotten wet. Dr. Z and Jane must have some pull here, I thought, to get me in so quickly. The best-dressed people entering the building were the two pharmaceutical reps who checked in with their gleaming, starched white shirts and blazing ties. One was from Pfizer and the other was from Glaxo, and they were whisked through the locked room that led to the inner sanctum of the clinic, carrying their sample cases. I knew the doctors inside used pills in their practice, of course. It was these guys who brought them. Some pills to bring you up, some to level you off, and some to bring you down. But I knew, and I was sure the doctors also knew, that they didn't have enough pills to cover every need. Was there a pill for loneliness? Or one for regret? A pill to help you forget? Or one to bring you love? Kindness? Grace? Understanding? How about a money pill? A family pill? A pill to restore the nectar of life that had soured or had never been tasted? Was there some magic elixir that could be drunk or splashed on for happiness? I wished I could capture that joy smell that Willow discovers as she rolls in the grass, all four legs flailing in the air, wiggling and rubbing the essence into every possible inch of her body. If I could put that joy in an aerosol can, I would just start spraying. As I sat there with Willow in my lap, waiting for an appointment, I looked out the window at the patients roaming outside the clinic. They appeared to have found a spirit of camaraderie in this place where they came to receive guidance, along with doses of kindnesses and dignity, and pills. It was a sanctuary of acceptance. In the outside world, they were often treated with disdain by people who, three blocks away, were paying $4.75 for mocha lattes and rushing home to watch men dunking basketballs for $12 million a year, and contestants eating live lizards and animal excrement for a chance to win $100,000. I had been waiting for about an hour now and was getting thirsty. I spotted a water cooler in the hall and went for a drink. Just as I was bending over to slurp some H2O, I heard a voice behind me. "Don't drink the water." I turned to see a tall, slender man with an enormous beard reaching halfway down his chest, peering at me. "They put chemicals in the water to keep us calm," he whispered before walking off. I went back to my seat. A few minutes later, a young man in his early 30s came bursting through the door. He wasn't wearing a shirt, and he was dripping wet. He walked straight up to the counter unbuckled his pants, and dropped them to the floor. "Help me!" he yelled to the receptionist. "I'm all wet, and they are crawling all over me. Get them off! Get them off!" Two men came rushing from behind the locked doors to usher this flailing soul into another room, dragging pants and all. This was more like the mental institution I expected. I spied a magazine rack in the corner and ambled over in search of something to read. There, between a three-month-old copy of National Geographic and the large print version of Reader's Digest, was a copy of Scientology. It occurred to me that someone was playing a cruel joke on this institution. I picked up a very dated copy of Arizona Highways from the rack and settled in for what felt like an interminable wait. At least now I knew how to get instant service if I felt so inclined. I had finished the article about the town square in Prescott, taken a flight to Phoenix, and was heading for the rocks of Sedona when I felt a presence standing over me, casting a shadow over the red rock cliffs I was admiring. "Richard?" a voice asked. "Yes?" I answered, looking up. "My name is Rodney," the man said. "Would you come with me?" He turned and walked toward the door that led to the inner realm of the mental institution. At his nod, the receptionist pushed a button that opened the door, and Rodney held it open for Willow and me. Rodney was my psychologist. He was not what I expected. Instead of a white coat, he was wearing earth tones, a green and black plaid cotton shirt and tan khaki pants frayed around the cuffs. His brown shoes were well worn, even cracked on top from the weather. He wore two necklaces. One appeared to be a plastic whale on a leather cord, and the other was a small chain with some type of medallion, but I could not tell what was inscribed on it. I expected a couch. "Pull up a chair," Rodney said, pointing to a brown metal chair along the wall. "I'll be with you in a minute. I just need to fill out this paperwork before I forget what I'm supposed to do." He picked up a folder and pen and began writing. I looked around Rodney's office while he was doing his work. There were two large buttons on the wall, one marked Code Red and the other Code Blue. I surmised that they were to be pushed when a client threatened one of the doctors or the president or began taking off his or her clothes. Rodney reached over and grabbed a Tupperware bowl containing a concoction of fruit salad, romaine lettuce, chunks of cheddar cheese, and pine nuts, and shoveled in a few bites as he wrote. I noticed several framed pictures behind his desk. One was of a white water raft bouncing in the waves. Another was of Rodney standing outside beside the boat holding an oar. "This is just my luck," I thought to myself. While other patients were getting doctors in white coats with miracle cures, I was getting a tour guide. Rodney finished his paperwork, took one more bite of salad, and picked up a file folder with my name on the front. "Sorry that took so long," he said. "That's okay," I said. "I have no place to go." "Let's do a quick test," he said, looking me in the eyes. "Will you count backwards from 100 by threes?" 97, I said. 94, 91, I think. 88, I began counting on my fingers. 85, 82, Rodney was urging me on as I struggled. 79, 76, 73, 70, that's good enough, he said. "Would you do the alphabet backwards?" Z, I began. Y, X, W, or is it U, I asked. "That's okay, I can't do that either." Rodney then scooted his desk chair back and wheeled over to a pile of papers on his desk and began shuffling them around. "Darn, I had them here just yesterday," he muttered to himself and shuffled some more. Here they are." He grabbed a file, picked up the papers, and pulled one out. "Would you please connect the dots?" He handed me the paper. 1 through 20, he added. "Sure," I said. "You need a pen," he said, reaching into his empty shirt pocket. He pushed his chair back again and began the process of moving the papers around to unearth his pens. "Here it is," he said, picking it up and handing it to me. I quickly connected the dots as he asked, remembering I had done the same thing on the menu at Denny's the night before. When I was done, I handed it to Rodney. "That's good," he said, putting it in the file. "That's enough, Tess." He leaned back in his chair. "I understand you are depressed." Then I began to tell my story. I told him how my business had failed, how deeply I was leveraged, and how I couldn't pay back loans. I told him about the bankruptcy. I told him how, when the loans were called, the bank took all I owned. I lost my rented home and all my possessions. I told him about the shame and despair, about how Sandra had left, about how my friends had rejected me, about my eventual eviction. I told him about the debilitating depression, about the burden I became to my children, and how they, too, had had enough of me. With every word, every sentence, every paragraph, I became more depressed until I was weeping uncontrollably. It was then that Rodney stood up, pulled me close, and hugged me. He held me until I felt a sense of peace, a sense of quiet come over me. It seemed like an hour. A hug, the elixir for the human soul. When I quit trembling, I knew I was lucky to have found this tour guide. If I was ever going to get out of the raging rapids that were tossing me about in this part of my life, he might be able to lead me back to the shore. I felt Rodney's arms beginning to release me. "Hey, Richard," he said, "sit down for a moment while I make a couple of notes to myself. I'd like you to meet someone." I sat down again, and Rodney grabbed his yellow notepad and began writing. After a minute or two, he reached over, picked up his bowl of food, and took another bite. When he finished his paperwork, he reached for the phone and pushed a button. "Bob, you got a minute?" "Good. I've got somebody I want you to meet. We'll be right down." He stood up and looked at me. "Let's take a walk down the hall. I want you to meet Bob." I followed Rodney out of the office, around the corner, and down the hall to another small office. The door was open, and the man was sitting at a desk, writing. "Bob," Rodney interjected, "I want you to meet Richard." The man stood up, extended his hand, and smiled. "Good to meet you," he said. "Bob is our psychiatrist," Rodney said. "He might have some ideas that will help you. I'll leave you two alone." "Have a seat," Bob motioned to a couple of chairs against the wall. He then picked up a box of cookies from his desk. "Would you like one?" he asked, holding the package out to me. "Sure," I said, taking the box from his hand. "Take all you want," he said as I dug in. "Would you like some coffee to go with them?" "Sure." "I'll get it for you and be right back," he said, getting up from his chair and backing out the door to the hall. I took a bite of cookie and surveyed Bob's office. He had three Monet reproductions hanging on the walls. I stood up and examined each one as I took bites of the cookies. Fuzzy flowers, fuzzy boats, fuzzy people, I thought, as I looked at the paintings. "Here's your coffee," Bob said, reappearing at the office door. He handed me the cup, and I sat down in the chair. Bob slowly backed into his chair, an old high-back leather chair with wheels, a comfortable chair. "I spoke with Rodney at the coffee machine, and he told me a little bit about you while I filled your cup," he said, rolling his chair forward and leading toward me. I knew I was going to have to tell my story again, the depressing story, the story I was so trying to escape. "Can you tell me what happened?" And so I began again, trying to be objective. I focused my eyes on the Monet painting on the wall behind Bob's mahogany desk, wishing I could somehow slip into that serene pastel world. I could hear my voice telling the story of loss again, but it was as if a kind narrator had stepped in to help out this time, and I just listened. I listened to the sad story, wanting so much to help the man, but could not. The narrator explained that some of my advertising clients had gone bankrupt and others had left my company to invest in the internet, taking with them what was left of my business. He told me that my three children had once worked for me and that they had once admired me, depended on me, and believed in me. But when I could not pay back loans from banks and from friends, I hid in shame. I refused to answer telephones and prayed for a miracle. I went from being someone admirable to being someone terrified that I would be accused of fraud. Now my children saw a different father, one shrouded in misery. I was the dependent one now. I could no longer help myself. My companion, Sandra, had loved me, loved my confidence and my wry smile. Now she saw a fearful, angry stranger with slumped shoulders. She would not stick around and watch my demise, and so she packed her possessions into a moving van and left to start a new life. Depression became my constant companion. I closed my eyes to shut out the light, wishing I could just go to sleep. But the voice went on with the story. When I opened them again, I saw another man in the room who looked just like me. He was dressed in the same burgundy cashmere sport coat I used to wear with blue dress pants. He wore a white starched shirt and a Frank Lloyd Wright tie. He interrupted the voice of the narrator. "He is a good man," Mr. Sportcoat said to Bob. "He is just lost. First," he said, holding up one finger, "he lost his job. Then," he held up a second finger, "his companion, the woman he loved, the one who wrote 'I love you' notes and put them in his sock drawer. And then," fingers 3 through 7 went up sequentially, "he lost his home, his friends, his children and grandchildren, his identity, his belief in God, and then his belief in himself. It has just been too much. Right now, he needs a place to get out of the cold, to take a shower, to sleep." Bob lifted his pen from the notepad and looked off into space. The room was quiet. "We don't have a place for him," he said to Mr. Sportcoat. "He's supposed to be in his prime right now. He's not supposed to be here. He's supposed to be investing in his retirement portfolio and planning his next vacation. He's supposed to be playing with his grandchildren on the weekends. If he had robbed a bank or killed someone, then the state would spend the money necessary to lock him up. We just don't have a place. But we will find some way to help him somehow." "Well, do what you can do," Mr. Sportcoat said as he adjusted his handsome tie. He got up and left the room. I remembered having 3 or 4 of those ties. I sold them one day for $1 each at a second-hand store. I needed gas money. I always needed gas money. The sonorous narrator was coming to the end of my story when I felt 2 hands placed tenderly on my cheeks, gently tugging my attention back to the man I sat with in this small office. "Richard, you've lost virtually everything that seemed to give your life meaning," Bob said, looking deeply in my eyes. "Most people could not have lived through that. You must feel like Job himself." My narrator was gone. "You have every right to be angry and sad and depressed," Bob said. "I am just happy you are here." Tears filled my eyes again. "There is hope," he continued. "We know that." Then he, too, lifted me from my chair and gave me a hug. "I know it is difficult to believe right now," I heard his muffled voice say through the hug, "but you are better now than you have ever been. You just need a warm place to live and some time to heal. Don't expect miracles. It will take time." Then Bob pulled away. I immediately knew he had other people to see and other places to go. He had patched me up as best he could. "We need to schedule another appointment," he said, looking at his calendar. "How about next Wednesday at 2 in the afternoon? "Okay," I said. Bob wrote it down. I left the mental institution that day with a small glad bag of hope. I knew it would not last long. I needed a miracle. I needed lots of miracles.
That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The Bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.